we're going to win so much that you're going to be sick and tired. You're going to say, please, please, Mr. President, we're sick and tired of winning. Please, let us have at least one loss. It's no longer exciting to win. And I'm going to say, no way. We're going to keep winning, and I don't care if you like it or not. Donald Trump.
Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to another episode of Court is in Session. And just to prove that I do have more than two friends, I have invited on a good friend of mine, Mr. Alex Hinson, a former Trump administration official. So, Mr. Hinson, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Court. I'm happy to be here. And we've been talking about doing this for quite some time now. So, you know, we're finally getting to sit down. Things are a little less hectic and happy for a discussion.
I'm excited about it, too. So one question that I like to ask all of my guests the first time they're on the show is, if you could live in any government throughout world history, you could pick one. Which one would it be?
So we did briefly discuss this before. And I think, given my unique insight into the Trump administration, based on numerous factors, I think the years of 2017 through 2020 in the United States under President Trump's leadership was probably the greatest span or spurt in civilization, modern civilization at that. So it's very unique in a sense of technology and technological advancement. So for me, someone who likes to be comfortable and enjoy the finer things of life, like good wine and phenomenal beef from all over the world, until about 1960, not very many people left the 100-mile radius around their home. Well, now, obviously, 60 years after that, we travel and we take world travel for granted. We take that, I can order wine from France and beef from Japan and eat that all at once and drink that all at once. So when you look at the globalist landscape currently, and under President Trump, we had record low unemployment for minorities. We had an unbelievable thriving economy, and people were in good spirits. Sure, there were the negative sides of everything. There always are. But I think when you take the whole of where the world is, where we all stand from a convenience side of things in today's society, that was a really good 4 years.
My grandpa used to have a saying whenever somebody would reminisce a little too fondly about the past. He would say, yeah, they were the good old days that never were. And I think about that sometimes, because I'm personally of the opinion that for the most part, human civilization only advances onward and only gets better. And I think people like to make crises out to be a lot more than they are. Because they're living in it, and they assume that these are unprecedented and worse times than ever because we're living in it. And yes, sometimes things get, marginally worse or marginally better, but on the whole of civilization, I think things are getting better. So that's really cool that you're able to put it all in perspective and say, yeah, last 4 years were really, really good. And, I would assume you would say they're probably a little bit better than under this current administration.
Yeah, that's a fair assumption. Yeah, we had it pretty good. Everybody, I think, had it pretty good. Now, every person has their own internal struggles, and what life throws at you can alter your plans. But when you look at it as a whole, where society is, you got to look at the recent past. So that's why I had to go with the Trump administration. I don't really know where else I would rather have lived. Even in the great European, middle-aged scenarios and leadership, food was a hard commodity to come by.
Yeah.
And we don't have that. You can go to a buffet. Yeah. You ever been to a Fogo de Chao?
I've heard only the best things, though. I've been meaning to.
Right. So they come by, meat on a spit, all the vegetables, all the dessert, whatever you want, you can just go have it. And that didn't exist until about 25 years ago. So when I factor all that in, I got to go recent history, and I got to go with President Trump. I'm a day one, started with him in the end of 2015, and that's my guy.
That's your guy.
Yeah.
trying to think of what do you think was it about Trump in particular? Is it all of his campaign points, or was there a special kind of energy within working in his administration? Because yeah. I know one of the things that really appeals to people, including myself, about Trump is that, you know, he wasn't some greasy Washington insider. Like, he's like, you know, I'm going to make this better. And he came in and made things better. Was that kind of something that – was that an energy that was all up and down the Trump administration and something that made him especially, like, exciting to work for?
So that was more so in the 2016 campaign.
Okay.
It was such a small team, a coordinate of people working together, all under the vision of Donald Trump, who was a businessman. He was a New Yorker. He was well known for, you know, building these things. You could see his results, tangible results in his work. He also had unbelievable name IDs, so there was enthusiasm from the beginning, right?
Sorry to interrupt, but how early did you jump on the campaign?
My first interviews were in December of 2015,
okay,
and I became the Arkansas state director. So I did that through the primary on Super Tuesday. I was the only staff in the state. My old boss, she lived in Oklahoma at the time. I'd go pick up yard signs on Sunday mornings in Oklahoma City, drive back to Little Rock, and by the time I got home, I had no more yard signs. I had a full network of volunteers that would meet me on I-40 at certain rest stops. They'd pick up, you know, 500, 1,000 signs, and they'd drive to their parts of the state. So, you know, I got to see it at a very grassroots early level. And then when I started traveling around doing advanced trips, which happened right after Super Tuesday, I got to see it nationally. And I was doing these events and these rallies and these smaller donor dinners. And it really opened my eyes to the more broad movement that I had already been accustomed to as a fan of his. But I really saw the enthusiasm. I saw, you know, people in Wisconsin lining up at 6 a.m. for a 7 p.m. rally, just so excited.
Yeah.
And you could never discount that, but it was his energy. And working for him, you had to maintain the same energy he had.
Yeah.
So very unique, and I never will discount my own personal time there. It was incredible. So once we got to the administration, it slightly changed. You did have more of these Washington insiders coming with institutional knowledge. We were all Trump people, a lot of us very new to politics.
Right.
And so when we got here, the old, you know, we called them the Bush people. The Bush people had a unique understanding of D.C. that we just didn't have. So they came into leadership positions, and it kind of changed the tone. But that message was still driven from the top by Trump in these cabinet meetings down all the way through the agencies of what he wanted to accomplish. He's a man of very targeted words. He is long-winded. But it's general speak, right? It's not these big lawyer words, right? It's we're going to win big, right? It's the Trumpism. So he sent direction and it was executed.
Yeah, that's interesting. So one person that I talk about on this show a lot is Milton Friedman. He's my absolute favorite economist, and he has inspired me a lot intellectually. But the reason I bring him up is because he wrote a book in the middle of Ronald Reagan's second term, called The Tyranny of the Status Quo. And one of the things that he talks about is when a new president gets elected, they really only have like this 6-month period to be really effective in driving home their unique agenda before the rest of the Washington machine kind of takes that over. And that's why you see, as much as I love Ronald Reagan, me and my friends kind of talked about this on our Ronald Reagan show, where there was a little bit of a disconnect between Reagan's rhetoric and some of the policies he actually implemented. Reagan was a fantastic president, but there was a disconnect there. Trump's administration was different in that it seemed through the entirety of the 4 years, he really ran his presidency different. Is that just because, you know, even with Reagan, he was a governor before he was president. He was an informant for the FBI. Donald Trump really had none of that. Do you think that's part of it, or is it just a specific Trump energy that really was able to make him president different?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think for the first 6 months, we didn't have the proper learning curve. You know, Reince Priebus was in charge as the chief of staff and kind of tried to steer the ship, right? But there were a lot of people in the transition who knew DC and knew and kind of wanted to keep the status quo a little bit of continuing a Bush presidency. And by the time that got to the White House and got to President Trump's desk, he was like, no way, right? I don't know that for sure. I wasn't in the room for those, but just based on how he seems, it would be very hard to, you know, think that he would want to keep this status quo. That was everything he was against. We had a Republican House. We had a Republican Senate. It was time to push forward. And so we did accomplish a lot. And it was all his energy. That man is so energetic. He has so much stamina. He never stops. He never sleeps. It's work and push and win. He is a winner. And he wants to win. And whatever the playing field is, he's going to win.
Yeah. Do you think that Washington in general is, one, a different place? And I know that you weren't in Washington before working for the Trump administration. But is it your sense from talking to people that Washington is a different place? And kind of the follow-up to that, is it a better place because of Donald Trump? Or did with the new administration, who's completely opposite, you know, the Biden administration is just, you know, the insiders from 30 years ago, did they get scared with Trump and really kind of rear their ugly head and come back full force even more so than before?
I think it's a different place now.
Okay.
I think Trump showing up really did change the landscape. You know, I'll take Ted Cruz, for example. I think Ted Cruz is now more vocal against the establishment and against the media and against these controlled centers of power because of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump's rhetoric freed him up to be able to call out all of these, you know, ridiculous things. So Trump laid a framework down for a new age of politician to say, okay, I am for the people. I'm here for the people. I'm not going to get sucked into this swamp, and I'm going to stand up, and I'm going to say what I want. And I think that's also why Ron DeSantis has become so successful as the governor of Florida.
Yeah.
What was it yesterday? He went to USF and there were five students behind him and he told them they didn't have to wear their mask. This is all political theater. And a couple of them, he said, you know, leave the mask on if you want, but you don't have to do this.
Yeah.
I don't think that without a Trump presidency, you would have a politician say that in a room full of cameras. I think he freed them up to give them the ability to say what they truly felt and not suffer political consequence.
And I can actually speak firsthand to that because I worked on Ron DeSantis' campaign back when I was living in Florida. And so first of all, we would have no Governor Ron DeSantis without Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I actually looked not too terribly long ago, right when Trump tweeted out his endorsement of Ron DeSantis, I texted my little friend group and I'm like, have y'all heard of this guy? And nobody had. But when you watch his debates in the primary and in the general, Ron DeSantis is actually kind of a nerd. He spoke like a college professor. But I think Donald Trump really gave him like a lot of – he channels his inner Donald Trump a lot.
Yeah.
And has become a lot louder and more vocal and like bashing the media and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And saying, like you said, like take the masks off.
But I think that's only a thing because of Trump. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's channeling his inner Donald Trump, but he probably didn't even know he had that inside him without seeing Trump do it. And I'm not saying this is the reason, but I think it was very successful to Donald Trump's being elected president was the fact that he did fight back. And people saw that and wanted it to expand to everything. They wanted a fighter. And, you know, DeSantis probably saw that Trump was good at that. Trump was successful, and that's part of the reason he was elected president, adopted it a little bit. I think he has some of that in him naturally, but it gave them the freedom to fight back. Because Trump took the force. He was the first guy to really get up there and do that kind of stuff. Nobody did that in politics. Can you imagine a Mitt Romney in 2012 telling a bunch of reporters that it's all fake news? No.
Yeah.
But it still was fake news then. It's just it took Trump's courage to open the door for all these politicians to speak the truth.
Yeah. So as far as having Donald Trump in a lot of ways has changed the way that the Republican Party has operated and is viewed, you know, we may have Donald Trump as president for another 4 years. But we're really looking at him being a major political figure for another 6 years. And then,
right.
you know, he's getting old. You know, he can only serve one more term constitutionally as president. Do you see any figures in the, do you see, first of all, this kind of Trump revolution being able to be sustainable? Do you think there are more people that can carry on the torch, or do you think that kind of peters out if he exits public life, when he exits public life?
No, this is a movement that's here to stay. There's groups in DC, you know, who are like AFPI, American First Policy Institute. Their whole mission right now is the next 100 years of the Trump legacy. This is a new party. This is not a Republican Party of old. This is essentially an America First policy, or excuse me, an America First party. And I think that's the whole mentality of what Trump put into place was common sense. It's not traditional fiscal conservatism. It's not even traditional social conservatism. It's now a common sense party to me.
Yeah.
And we just had to do it under the guise of Republicans because Democrats are so far gone at this point. They're so far left. I mean, it's crazy, right? When you think about these political parties, I view them as a circle. When you go so far left or right, you end up meeting somewhere on the bottom. I think at some point, the groups that are so far ultra-right and so far ultra-left will end up meeting each other at the bottom of the circle in
yeah.
the Southern Hemisphere. And Trump's message is uniting people. It's, you know, what we saw in Virginia. That wasn't even Trump. You know, Trump lost Virginia by 10 points, but Glenn Youngkin kind of did continue that Trump message. And then he won in the suburbs. He won in the schools. And that was a big part of the Trump administration. People don't talk about it, was education policy. A lot of school choice. But I think when this, you know, comes around in 2024, we're going to see it on the ballot in 22. But when it comes around in 24, people are going to be drawn to that. They're going to be drawn to safety and making their decisions for their children. And so I think for many reasons, the Trump message is here to stay. There's going to be lots of people to carry the torch, whether it's, you know, our age and the young Trump administration officials who later on decide to run for office. But there's definitely a significant group who's going to continue that torch. And you're seeing people start to run for Congress who, you know, I met very early on in the original campaign days, who are now, you know, up pretty big in their polling in certain races. So there's a message here that's going to stay.
Do you think that there's going to be a similar movement on the left? Because I think the Democratic Party is moving so far left. Like, mm-hmm. I think the old school, you know what I'm talking about when I say Dixiecrats, like mm-hmm. you're from Arkansas.
Blue Dogs. Yeah.
You know, the Clinton types.
Right. He's done. I mean, the old school Clinton politician is no more. Even a Hillary Clinton is no more. Mm-hmm. I think when they are looking, they as in the Democrats are looking at a predecessor to Joe Biden, they're running out of options.
Yeah.
It can't be him. I don't think they want it to be their vice president. And then the internal conflict that comes about when you want to promote a cabinet secretary to be like a Pete Buttigieg, to come be the new savior. You know, he's a young, charismatic figure, speaks numerous languages, you know, encompassing. That's what they go for. You know, Barack Obama had a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
Even Bill Clinton had a lot of that. I think that the party and the base is so far removed that they won't even relate to a Pete Buttigieg.
Really?
Well, we saw it, right? They loved Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
They loved they love AOC. They want a socialist style. They want the government to take care of everything. And I don't think Pete Buttigieg is that. And so I don't even see a natural predecessor to this Biden administration. I also didn't think that, you know, Joe Biden was going to be their nominee. I just didn't see it. When they got to South Carolina, I thought he was dead in the water, and then he won, and all of a sudden he gets on a roll. But I just don't ever see a Trump in their system that brings back the blue-collar workers of Pennsylvania and Ohio and Wisconsin. I mean, I just don't see it. I just don't see it.
Yeah, the Republican Party is definitely the new party of the blue-collar worker.
Yeah.
And the union workers themselves, I think, like, obviously top people, unions themselves are so corrupt. But union workers, I think, are starting to move right because they really don't like the way that the Democrat Party has been moving.
Well, it's because they work.
Yeah.
I think it's as simple as that. Like, if you're going and working and you spend hours in a factory every day and you do your 40 hours and yes, you get your union mandated breaks, whatever. And then you see what the left wants to do with your tax dollars. That is not a winning message. Of course they're going to go to the guy who's built buildings in New York and who understands construction. And that's the natural progression, is for them to be attracted to a Donald Trump-like figure or even a party who promotes work. The left and the liberals and the Democrats, they don't do that. They want to pay you to sit at home. We saw it in their failed COVID policies where they were paying people not to go to work. And then all of a sudden, restaurants who were closed by mandates who were now able to open couldn't because they didn't have the staff.
Yeah.
Why would a union worker support a party that wants that? So they don't have any chance.
Did you watch the State of the Union the other night?
I watched the first 8 minutes.
Yeah.
And fell asleep.
There you go.
Call me Sleepy Joe.
So
he put me to bed. By the way, we should start a coffee company called Sleepy Joe.
I love it.
You're a big coffee guy.
A huge coffee guy.
Yeah.
I could probably speak about as educatedly on coffee as you can on wine.
Beef and wine. Those are my things.
Beef and wine. Those are your things.
Let's talk a little wine.
Let's talk a little wine.
You want to tie it into politics?
If you think you can.
Our founding fathers were huge Francophiles. Yep. They loved France. They loved the French culture, the French people. And Thomas Jefferson was actually one of the first massive collectors of Bordeaux wine in the United States. So traditionally, Bordeaux wine is Merlot and Cabernet dominant blends. There's other grapes that you can put into the mix, such as Petit Verdot, Malbec, Cabernet Franc. So, you know, there's a lot of varietals, right? But Bordeaux is known for creating some of the best wines on the planet. So Chateau Aubryon is a left bank wine. It retails for, you know, anywhere between $600 and $2,000, depending on the year. But Thomas Jefferson, I think he brought like 20-something cases of wine back from France in the 1780s. And, you know, I've never tried Aubryon, but one day I'm going to.
One day. The founding fathers were famously alcoholics, and I'm flipping through my phone right now because – oh, here it is. The bar tab of the 1787 farewell party for George Washington, which was had just a few blocks – down from here in Old Town Alexandria.
It's a rowdy time.
It is. According to the bill, the founding fathers drank 54 bottles of Madeira, 60 bottles of Claret,
Claret is Bordeaux.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
60 bottles of that, which you said was how much a bottle?
Well, it depends. I'm sure they were drinking good stuff. Now it's, you know, around $1,000 a bottle.
8 bottles of whiskey, 22 bottles of porter, 8 bottles of hard cider, 12 bottles of beer, 7 bowls of alcoholic punch. That is for 55 gentlemen.
That is a party.
That is a great American party.
I love it. I kind of wish I was there.
Oh, you kidding? You know, I would love the conversation would be there.
I would have loved to have sat down with Thomas Jefferson at Monticello and drank a bottle of Chateau Aubryon from like a 1785 vintage or something. Like, how crazy, right?
Right.
But I will say the coolest part about the wines, right? These wines from Bordeaux, they've been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, but they have the history.
Right.
It's the same plot of land. It's the same grapes. It's the same vines.
Yeah.
And you're getting to drink that history. So that's part of the reason I like it so much, and they're delicious.
It's a connection to all the great people throughout history who have been able to drink it. And that's a universal cultural thing. Like, I haven't traveled too terribly much, but when I have, there's nothing more universal than sitting down with people with a nice glass of wine or a bottle of beer.
So where's your favorite place you've been in the world?
Well, I studied political philosophy and political economy at the University of Hong Kong. And that was absolutely the greatest trip of my life. I've made some friends that I still keep in touch with. Hong Kong was an incredible city. Unfortunately, I don't think the Hong Kong that I went to will ever exist anymore.
Yeah.
which is incredibly sad because it was a fantastic city. Either that or I got to travel to Israel, which being a man of faith myself was incredible.
Israel is special.
Have you ever been?
I have.
It's a great place.
There's no place like it. It really is just special.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to explain it. When you get to Jerusalem and you're in the old city and you're looking around, it kind of takes your breath away.
It does. Yeah. What about you? What's your favorite place you've traveled?
Well, now we say Israel. It's hard to go against that, but I really do enjoy relaxing. Mm. I think there's no place like the Mediterranean in the summer.
There you go.
And I've been very fortunate to visit a lot of the northern Mediterranean countries, Spain, France, Monaco, Italy, Greece, all over. The greatest to me, it's on the Aegean, is Montenegro. Mm. Montenegro is the hidden gem of the world. It is the most beautiful place. It's relatively cheap for European standards. When you're sitting there and you're looking at these massive mountains as they feed into the ocean, it almost looks like the Amalfi Coast, except for a bottle of water is, you get two bottles of water for €1 or euro, not euro. I'm thinking about food. I love a euro sandwich.
Same.
You know, but you get two bottles of water for €1, and then you're in Italy and you get one bottle for €3. So it's just, when you factor in all that, Montenegro is just heaven.
That's the place to go.
It's so good. Budva. It's the most beautiful place, man.
Now you're also a connoisseur of fine beefs, and you were kind enough to give me a little piece of the absolute best meat I've had in my life, which was a Wagyu A5, right?
Yeah, A5 Wagyu rib cap, which comes from a portion of the rib section. It's not quite a ribeye. It's a little sliver just off to it. But the A5 classification just has to do with carcass size. So by the time a cow gets to the size to be classified A5, it's older, it's more mature, it's bigger, and therefore there's a higher fat content in the meat, which is what marbling is, which is what Japanese beef is known for. Once you get into the marble scale, it goes up to 12. So anything like 8 to 12, that's A5, is going to melt in your mouth. So what I gave you was from Kagoshima, which is the southern island or southern tip of Japan. The genetics of Japanese beef, because they were for thousands of years, goes back to, you know, people never left 100 miles outside their home, really, until like the last 100 years. Same thing with cattle. They weren't crossbred. There weren't cattle drives in Japan. It was very concentrated, very clean genetics, very long lifespans. Now, in America, we're all go fast, right?
Yeah.
The average cow that we consume is about, you know, 11 to 13 months old. And in Japan, the average is about 28 to 38 months. So, you know, they're three times as old and it develops more flavor. But that's, the Japanese are a very patient people.
Yeah.
They don't gouge like us. You know, I'll go down and order a 16-ounce steak. You don't do that with Wagyu beef. You have a nice 4 to 6 ounce portion, and it's very rich. It's very delicious, but I'm glad you enjoyed it.
That was incredible. Did you grow up around steer, or do you just like food?
I've got a very close friend of mine who is very fluent, and his family would take us out to dinner in Arkansas, and there's one restaurant there at Arthur's Steakhouse, and they had Japanese Wagyu beef before it really popped up.
Mm.
Back when it was on no menu, no place had a Wagyu burger, which is a whole other conversation. That's all fake. But it wasn't publicly known, and they had Japanese tenderloin that was served by the ounce. And even back then, it was like $25, $30 an ounce.
Oh, sheesh.
Now it's double. But I got to try it when I was, I think, in eighth grade. And ever since, I was sort of obsessed, but I never bought it until some of these online services started offering it, and I started buying it in bulk. And now I'm at the point where I have enough in my freezer where I can give friends a taste.
There you go. Well, Alex, I like to keep these right around half an hour. But
are we already there?
We are already there. These go by really quickly.
Wow.
Is there anything else you want to leave my 3 or 4 listeners with?
No, I think you're going to have more listeners than that, right?
I generally get about, as of right now, I average about 30 listeners an episode.
That's pretty good.
It's not so
bad. No, I've got nothing. This was great. I'm glad we did it, and we'll do it again.
Thank you so much for hopping on the show, Alex.
All right.